Job 32, please. Job 32, I'd like to say that's the only text we'll be covering tonight, but as you can see from your outline, I'm going to try to cover six chapters. And I'm hoping that will be successful. I want to read to you at least portions of this 32nd chapter. Let's stand for this portion of reading of God's Word, please. So these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was roused against Job. His wrath was roused because he justified himself rather than God. Also because his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Now because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited to speak to Job. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, his wrath was aroused. So Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, answered and said, I am young in years, and you are very old. Therefore I was afraid and dared not declare my opinion to you. I said, age should speak, and multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there's a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. Great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. Therefore I say, listen to me. I will also declare my opinion. Indeed, I waited for your words. I listened to your reasonings while you searched out what to say. I paid close attention to you, and surely not one of you convinced Job or answered his words. Lest you say, we have found wisdom, God will vanquish him, not man. Now he has not directed his word against me, so I will not answer him with your words. They are dismayed and answer no more, words escape them. And I have waited because they did not speak, because they stood still and answered no more. I also will answer my part, I too will declare my opinion, for I am full of words. The spirit within compels me. Indeed, my belly is like wine that has no vent. It is ready to burst like new wineskins. I will speak that I may find relief. I must open my lips and answer. Let me not, I pray, show partiality to anyone, nor let me flatter any man, for I do not know how to flatter, else my Maker would soon take me away. You may be seated. Now, in our expositions of the book of Job thus far, there's been no mention of this young man by the name of Elihu. The dialogue that began in chapter 4 through chapter 31 has been between Job and his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. But in chapter 32, this man, Elihu, steps on the scene. But as we will see the substance of Elihu's long-winded monologue, it makes it clear that he was there from the very beginning. In fact, it was because of some of the things that he heard Job say and some of the things he did not hear the other three men say that caused him and prompted him to speak. He said that his emotions were pent up like fermenting wine in a wineskin, and he was ready to explode and felt compelled to speak. And speak he did. Chuck Swindoll, in his preaching on this text, or this portion of the book of Job, gave this story. He said a young preacher came to a new church, and the only one that was there was an old farmer. And he asked the old farmer what he should do. The old farmer said, well, son, I don't rightly know, but if I had one cow, I'd feed it. So the young preacher got up and preached for over an hour and a half, and when he was finished, he asked the old farmer what he thought, and he said, well, son, I don't rightly know, but when I said I would feed that one cow, I didn't mean the whole load. Well, Elihu dumps the whole load in his response to Job and his three friends. In fact, he goes on for six chapters. His monologue is longer than 12 Old Testament books and 17 of the 27 New Testament epistles. The problem is that it's difficult to know whether he added anything useful to the situation or not. But if we are careful in examining portion of this long monologue, we will find several nuggets of practical truth, as well as a masterful discourse on the greatness and the majesty of God. We'll not spend a lot of time on that, because God does that himself in the following chapters. Now, I've tried to outline these six chapters, and I've set that before you in three lines of thought. I want to look very briefly at the problems with the response of Elihu the Buzite. I want us to look at the reasons why he responded and try to look at the substance of his response. First of all, the problems with the response of Elihu. There are several problems with his response that on the surface of things causes us to wonder if he was helpful or not. Let me briefly mention what some of those are. He spent too much time beating around the bush. You notice as I read chapter 32, he began to speak and he never got to his point, or at least the first point, till he got to chapter 33 and verse 8. When he said in verse 32, verse 18, chapter 32, "I'm full of words," we would certainly agree with him on that. He came across as an arrogant know-it-all. Notice what he says in chapter 33, verses 1 through 3. "But please, Job, hear my speech and listen to all my words. Now I open my mouth." You see, he hasn't got to the point yet. He's still going on in a long, long introduction. "My tongue speaks in my mouth. My words come from my upright heart. My lips utter pure knowledge." Notice what he says over in chapter 36, verses 1 through 4. Elihu also proceeded and said, "Bear with me a little bit and I will show you that there are yet words to speak on God's behalf. I will fetch my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker, for truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." Now, how would you like to sit down and have counsel with someone who said, "I know all things, I have perfect knowledge, you listen to me, and I'll straighten you out on all of your situation." He was cruel in some of his accusations against Job. Notice what he says in chapter 34, verse 7 through 8. "What man is like Job who drinks scorn like water, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men?" And then at the end of chapter 34, he says in verse 34, "Men of understanding say to me, wise men who listen to me, Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without wisdom." And I find this is an incredible statement here in light of all that Job has been through. "Oh, that Job would be tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of wicked men." You can't believe that someone would say that about this man after what he's been through. It's similar to what another one said when they said that it was hopeful that what Job suffered is nowhere near compared to what he deserved. And as a result of all of these problems, many Bible students and commentators are confused as to whether Elihu's monologue added anything to the debate, whether it was helpful or more of just the same. But one thing is certain. Even though he will set forth a different perspective of suffering than Job's friends did, he too was convinced that Job was a great sinner, which shows that we have to take some of what he says with a grain of salt, because we know that he was wrong. Then I just want to briefly touch on the reasons for the response of Elihu the Buzite in chapter 32. He said he was angry with Job and his three friends. He was angry with Job because he felt that Job went too far in claiming that he was innocent of sin, thus blaming God for his hardship. Verse 2, "Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God." Then he went on to say that he was angry with Job's friends because they condemned Job without justification, and they could not get Job to reason and listen. They could not convince Job that he was a sinner, verse 3. And also against his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Verse 12, "I paid close attention to you, and surely not one of you convinced Job or answered his words." Secondly, he concluded that wisdom was not limited to age. back, because he was younger in relationship to Job's three friends, he chose to remain silent. In that society, those who were older were considered wiser. Therefore, those younger in age were expected to listen and to learn. It's something that maybe our young people ought to learn in this day and age. But after Job's final defense of himself, his three friends had nothing more to say. Therefore, Elihu felt that it was time for him to speak. He concluded that age did not have a corner on wisdom. Look at verse 6 through 9. So Elihu, the son of Barakel, the Buzzite, answered and said, I am young in years and you are very old. Therefore, I was afraid and dared not declare my opinion to you. I said, age or men of many years should speak, and a multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there's a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. Great men or aged men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. And thirdly, he was sitting there listening to all this long dialogue between Job and his three friends. He was convinced that they were not able to answer him. And he heard some of the things that Job was saying against God. And it was like all of his emotions were pent up in him. He says there in verse 18, for I am full of words. The spirit within me compels me. Indeed, my belly is like wine that has no vent. It is ready to burst like new wineskins. I will speak that I may find will relief. I must open my lips and answer. He was ready to explode, and he felt that he had to speak. Now that brings us to the primary concern of our sermon tonight, the substance of the response of Elihu the Buzzite. In spite of introducing this young man in a rather negative vein, we find that he does add dimensions to the issue of suffering and adversity. Remember, all of Job's friends, the only thing they could think of, if you're going through hard times, you're a wicked sinner and God is judging you, you need to repent, Job. That was their theme, that was their primary thought, and everything they said was based on that presupposition. But Elihu shows that there's another dimension, several other dimensions, to the issue of suffering and adversity, and he does this in two ways. First, in rebuking Job for some of the accusations he did make against God, and Job said some pretty hard things against God. But secondly, by a lengthy discourse on various aspects of God's character, namely his perfect justice and sovereign power, all of which was designed to renew Job's perspective of God, a perspective that had become distorted as a result of the unprecedented adversity that came upon Job, and the fact that God seemed to be totally detached from him. He did not answer him. He gave him no encouragement. And Job's perspective of God had been completely distorted. And I think Elihu is helpful, at least, in bringing Job back to a proper perspective of God. Now, in analyzing Elihu's monologue, it's important that we remember he was ignorant of the heavenly contest between God and Satan, just as Job and his three friends were ignorant of that. Therefore, we must expect obvious flaws in some of the things that he says. He does not know many of the things that took place in heaven. Without the full picture, any attempt to analyze Job's suffering will come up short. But in spite of that, I think we'll find that Elihu does bring valuable insight into this very complex situation. First of all, his rebuke of Job for the charges he made against God, and that'll cover chapter 33 through chapter 35 and verse 16. So that we do not analyze Elihu's response in isolation of Job's suffering, we need to remind ourselves of the things that Job was made to endure. Job had lost all of his possessions and his vast wealth in one day. This included the brutal murder of an untold number of his faithful workers. Others were killed by a freakish electrical storm. He and his wife had recently buried their 10 children. He was covered with pain and boils from head to foot. He was racked with fever and he could not sleep, and when he did sleep, he was tormented by horrible nightmares. The most respected, influential man in the East had become an outcast, living on an ash heap, scraping the pus and the worms from his sores with pieces of broken pottery. He had been abandoned and afraid, forsaken by everyone. He had become a hideous-looking monster. His own flesh and blood recoiled in disgust when they saw him. And we know from the first two chapters of this book that the adversity that came upon him was not due to any unconfessed or unmortified sin in Job's life. God delivered Job over to Satan on two occasions. And he delivered him totally over to Satan except for two different restrictions. Everything that he has, you can touch, but not him. And Satan took full advantage of it. He took everything that Job had, including 10 of his children. And then on the second occasion, he says, you can do anything to Job personally, but you can't take his life. And Satan took full advantage of it. And God did this to prove that Job did not serve him out of selfish reasons and that his faith was genuine, but Job had no way of knowing this. Therefore, Job felt justified in protesting his innocence. And when he sought God for answers, God seemed to be silent. In fact, there is no record that God ever told Job why these things happened to him. Because he was innocent of any unmortified sin and God seemed to be silent, Job came to the conclusion that God had become his enemy. It was a false conclusion, but to Job it seemed like the only reasonable conclusion. Now in this portion of Elihu's monologue, he seeks to use a repetitive reproach. He quotes Job's charge against God and then seeks to refute that charge. First of all, the charge by Job that God was his enemy and did not hear him in chapter 33. We see the quote of Job's charge, that God was his enemy in chapter 33 and verse 8. Look at it, please. Surely you have spoken in my hearing. I have heard the sound of your words saying, I am pure without transgression, I am innocent, there's no iniquity in me. Yet he finds occasion against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks and he watches all my paths. Now, Job basically said that. That's not an accurate word-for-word quote by Job, but it is an accurate reflection of what Job had said. Look at chapter 13. I want to be careful that I don't go back and forth to what we covered before. It didn't take up too much time. But look at chapter 13 and we'll see that that's what Job said in effect. In verse 23. And he's speaking to God at this point. Job 13 verse 23. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and regard me as your enemy? There it is. Will you frighten a leaf driven to and fro, and will you pursue dry stubble? For you write bitter things against me, and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet in the stocks, and watch closely all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet. Now go back to chapter 33, because Elihu seeks to refute that charge that God was his enemy. Now, in answering the charge by Job that God was his enemy and did not hear him, Elihu deals with the second point first. Here he seeks to give insight into the ways that God speaks. If what he says is true, then God was speaking to Job and was not silent. But in many cases, he says man does not know that God is speaking to him. Look at verse 12, chapter 33. Look at this. You are not righteous. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend with him? For he does not give an accounting of any of his words. For God may speak in one way or another, yet man does not perceive it. Now, in answering this charge, we see that he goes on to say that before the New Testament was written, God spoke in various ways, sometimes through dreams and vision. Elihu says this way of speaking was to keep man from sin and perishing in their sins. Look at verse 15. In a dream. In a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls upon men while slumbering on their beds. Then he opens the ears of men and seals their instruction. Notice, in order to turn men from his deed and conceal pride for men, to keep He keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword. God was speaking sometimes, Job, in some of those dreams you were having to try to do you good. Then he goes on to say that God uses pain and suffering for our good. Verse 19, man is also chastened with pain on his bed and with strong pain in many of his bones. So that his life abhors food and his soul succulent food. His flesh wastes away from sight, and his bones stick out, which once were not seen. Yes, his soul draws near to the pit, and his life to the executioner. Then he says, here we find Elihu departing from the concept that suffering is always punitive, but also corrective. In other words, suffering sometimes comes from the hand of God to correct us and keep us from various sins. Remember when Paul said that he was given the thorn of the flesh? He said, lest I be exalted above measure, there was given me a thorn in the flesh. God anticipated that Paul was going to fall into the sin of pride and therefore gave him that affliction, whatever it was. Look at verse 23. If there's a messenger for him, and most translations say an angel, for him a mediator, one among a thousand, to show men his uprightness, then he is gracious to him and says, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. His flesh shall be like a child's. He shall return to the days of his youth. He shall pray to God, and he will delight in him. He shall see his face with joy and restores to man his righteousness. And he looks at men and says, I have sinned and perverted what was right, and it did not profit me. He will redeem his soul from going down to the pit, and his life shall see the light. Behold, God works all these things, twice in fact, three times with a man, to bring his soul from the pit, that he may be enlightened with the light of life. Job, the fact that you are suffering doesn't mean that God is against you, but he's for you. Suffering is not always the result of his wrath, but it's evidence sometimes of his love. Whom the Lord loves, he chastens. We don't always appreciate that when we're laying on our beds filled with pain and suffering, but C.S. Lewis says this, God whispers to us in our pleasure, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to arouse a deaf world. We see then that he refuted the charge that God was his enemy and did not hear. He tried to show him that that's not necessarily true. God sometimes uses affliction because he loves us and he cares for us. Secondly, the charge by Job that God is unjust. This marks the second speech by Elihu. He speaks first to the three men as evidenced by the plural pronoun. Look at verse 34. Chapter 34, I'm sorry. Elihu further answered and said, hear my words, you wise men, give ear to me, you who have knowledge. And then he goes on and speaks the charge that Job made against God that he's unjust. He asked these men to consider what they heard Job say in charging that God was unjust, verses 5 and 6. For Job has said, I am righteous, but God has taken away my justice. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. But here is where Elihu falls right back into the same charge like Job's three friends and begins to use character assassination against Job. He says, what man is like Job who drinks scorn like water? Who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men? For he has said, it profits a man nothing that he should delight in the Lord. In other words, what advantage is there in walking a godly life? What advantage is there in seeking to walk in the ways of God? And we'll open that up in just a few moments. Then he goes on to speak about the fact that this could never be. God is not unjust. Is totally contrary to the character of God. Look at verse 10. Therefore, listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness and from the Almighty to commit iniquity. Verse 12. Surely God will never do wickedly. nor will the Almighty pervert justice. Now, much of what Elihu says here is very profitable for us, especially when we become the victims of gross injustice, or you're going through hard times and it seems like the people who are around you that are unsaved, they don't seem to go through those difficult times. Whoever's got that machine on, shut it off right now. That's very distracting, and it should not be in the house of God. I don't want it in here again. Elihu rose to defense of the character and justice of God. Look what he says. God is just in judging or rewarding men according to their works. Verse 11. For he repays men according to his works and makes men to find a reward according to his ways. He says God is received. This is a good point. God received his sovereign authority from no one but himself, and therefore he's answerable to no one. Verse 13. Who gave him charge over the earth? Or who appointed him over the whole world? He goes on to say, God is the giver of all life and has the right to sustain or take away life. Verse 14. And this is a powerful thought. If he should set his heart on it, if he should gather to himself his spirit and his breath, all flesh would perish together and man would return to dust. God is so powerful that if he just chose to remove life from everyone, man would perish and return to the dust. God is not a respecter of persons. They are all the work of his hands. He alone determines their end. Verse 20. In a moment they die in the middle of the night. The people are shaken and pass away. The mighty are taken away without a hand. Fourthly, God is all-knowing, judge of the whole earth. Nothing is hidden from his eyes. Now we find this all through the scriptures. For his eyes are on the ways of man, and he sees all his steps. There is no darkness, no shadow of death, where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. For he need not further consider a man that he should go before God. He breaks in pieces mighty men without iniquity. See, Job was constantly saying, oh, if I could only come before the bar of God's justice. If I could only come and present my defense before God, then I know God would vindicate me. But Elihu says, no, God knows everything. There's no way you can come before God. Look, for he need not further consider a man that he should go before God in judgment. God knows every single thing about you, Job. There's nothing you're going to say that's going to change anything. And he says, God is an absolute executioner of the wicked because they refuse to walk in his ways and they close their ears to the cries of the oppressed. Look at the middle of verse 25. He overthrows them in the night and they are crushed. He strikes them as wicked men in the open sight of others because they turn back from him and would not consider any of his ways. So that they cause the cry of the poor to come to him, for he hears the cry of the afflicted. When he gives quietness, who then can trouble him? And when he hides his face, who then can see him? Having refuted Job's charge that God was unjust in his dealings with him, Elihu makes a pointed application of Job. He does so by drawing on a theological discussion between some unknown person who wants to present their case before God. In reality, he was referring to Job. In verse 31. For has anyone said to God, I have borne chastening, I will offend no more. Teach me what I do not see. If I have done iniquity, I will not do no more. Should he repay it according to your terms? He's saying, Job, who has ever said, Lord, I've been afflicted? And this is what Job has basically said. If I've sinned, show me what that sin is, and then I'll not do it again. And Elihu basically says, in light of what I pointed out about the character of God, you think you can get God to deal with you on your terms? Look at verse 33. Should he repay it according to your terms just because you disavow it? And then Elihu then resorts once again to his acrostic attack on Job, a thing that he said that he would never do. Verse 34, men of understanding say to me, wise men who listen to me, Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without wisdom. Oh, that Job would be tried to the uttermost, because his answers are like those of wicked men. For he adds rebellion to his sin, he claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Job, the wisest men have talked to me about you. They listen to me and they say, Job talks like a fool. And my hope is that God really unloads on him and gives him everything he deserves. Oh, that Job were tried to the uttermost because he speaks like a vile, wicked man. He rejects our counsel and he continues to speak evil against the Lord. And this cruel attack against Job is similar to the words of Zophar back in 11 verse 6, who said that, Job, the things that have happened to you are far less than you deserve. We know that that's true of all of us. But he was speaking in relationship to Job's suffering. Job, you're such a vile, wicked sinner that all of the adversity that has come upon you is a pinprick compared to what you really deserve. And Elihu was basically saying the same thing. One of the commentators said, Elihu's attitude matches that of Satan. Hit a man hard enough and he will break. Then the charge by Job that it's useless to serve God in chapter 35, and that's the third speech of Elihu. You have the quote of Job's charge that living godly is unprofitable. Look at chapter 35, verses 1 through 3. Moreover, Elihu answered and said, do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I have sinned? I might as well go out and have sinned. I mean, I'm getting judged just like a sinner. What profit was there for me in serving God? Now, Job never said that he was more righteous than God. That's a false charge by Elihu. He said more than Job actually said. But he implied that it was useless to serve God and live godly, since the wicked often prosper, live many years in their wickedness, and they seem to get away with it. Look at chapter 24. Chapter 24. He's going discoursing on the violence that's going on in the earth. And he says, verse 9, some snatch the fatherless from the breast and take a pledge from the poor. They cause the poor to go naked without clothing. They take away the sheaves from the hungry. Notice verse 12, the dying groan in the city and the souls of the wounded cry out, yet God does not charge them with wrong. And go back to chapter 5, 35, you see how Elihu refutes that charge that God, serving God is unprofitable. Verse 4. I will answer you, your companions with you. Look to the heavens and see, and behold the clouds which are higher than you. If you sin, what do you accomplish against him? Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give him, or what does he receive from your hand? Now, according to the Hebrew scholars, this is all muddled. Very, very difficult to even understand what it's saying, even when you try to translate it from the Hebrew. But let me give it a shot. He's basically saying, if the heavens and the clouds are higher than man, then the creator of those things are much higher than greater than man. God is so great that there is a sense that he's unaffected by any of the works of man, be they wicked or be they righteous. Elihu was not saying that God was oblivious and indifferent to the works of man, but he seems to be saying that God's actions are determined by him alone. God is impartial. He does not alter his righteous standards by what man does or doesn't do. Wickedness and righteousness may influence or bribe others, but not God. The works of men do not affect God, but they affect men. Job, your wickedness has an effect upon you, and your righteousness influences others. Look at verse 8. Your wickedness affects a man such as you, and your righteousness a son of man. Job not only implied that it was useless to serve God because the wicked seem to get away with their wickedness, but God seems to be oblivious to the cry of the oppressed. Remember, we just saw that. The oppressed cry out, and where's God? He doesn't seem to answer them. At this point, Elihu gives us insight into this matter. And I think this is important. Why is it that there are times when the downtrodden, when those who are sick, afflicted, when those who are struggling with oppression cry out to the Lord, but He doesn't answer them? God does not always answer the prayers of the oppressed because of the motives behind their prayers. Many times, God is just a genie in a bottle to be used when they are in trouble. Look at verse 9. Because of the multitude of oppression, they cry out. They cry out for help because of the arm of the mighty. But they do not recognize Him as their Creator. Verse 10. But no one says, where is God my Maker? They don't recognize God as their Creator. They don't feel they're accountable to God in any way. They just know that God is powerful. They're being oppressed and they want someone to help. They do not see Him as a God of all comfort. The end of verse 10. Who gives songs in the night. Neither do they look to God for wisdom and instruction. Verse 11. Who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of heaven. Then he goes on to say, they cry out from their own pride. There they cry out, but He does not answer because of the pride of evil men. Surely God will not listen to empty talk, well, nor will the Almighty regard it. Job, you have said that you cannot find God, but He's a just God. You must wait for Him to move in your behalf. Verse 14. Although so you say you do not see Him, yet justice is before Him and you must wait for Him. Another thing, Job. Just because God does not judge the wicked immediately, you assume that He's indifferent to all those evil things. Job, your words are empty and stupid. Verse 15. And now because He has not punished in His anger, nor taken much notice of folly, therefore Job opens his mouth in vain. He multiplies words without knowledge. Then in chapters 36 through 37, most commentators, and I think I'd have to agree, say that this is probably the most glorious aspect of Elihu's discourse. Because he focuses on various aspects of the character of God. Look at chapter 36, verses 1 through 4. We have to also swallow the statement he made about his perfect knowledge. But he is eager to come to a defense of God's character. Elihu also proceeded and said, bear with me a little and I will show you that there are yet words to speak on God's behalf. I will fetch my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. So his motive is pure. But then he's a little bit puffed up by himself. For truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you. Now in his discourse on the aspect of the character of God, he deals, first of all, with the righteous judgments of God in His dealing with man. First of all, His righteous judgments with His dealing with the righteous. Verse 5, behold, God is mighty, but despises no one. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not preserve the life of the wicked, but gives justice to the oppressed. He does not withdraw His eyes from the righteous, but they are on the throne with kings. For He has seated them there forever, and they are exalted. Then there are two responses that the righteous can have to affliction, because he doesn't hide the fact that there are times when God will bless the righteous, but He will also afflict the righteous. Look at verse 8. Having said, for He has seated them forever and they are exalted, and if they are bound in fetters, held in cords of affliction, then He tells them their work and their transgression, that they have acted defiantly. And here we have these two responses that can often come from the righteous. And here we find one of those precious nuggets of truth that are so important to us. If the righteous submit to the affliction that God brings into their life and obey and serve the Lord, in the end they will be blessed. Verse 11. If they obey and serve Him, they shall spend their days in prosperity, in their years and pleasure. But if they resist and rebel against the Lord, they will die without ever having learned anything from their affliction. Look at verse 12. But if they do not obey, they shall perish by the sword. They shall die without knowledge. Then he deals with the righteous judgment of his dealing with sinners in verses 13 through 15. And then he applies this to Job in verse 16. Indeed, he would have brought you out of dire distress into a broad place where there is no restraint. And what is set on your table would be full of riches. But you are filled with the judgment due to the wicked. You see, that's that same mindset that Job's other three friends had. Justice and judgment and justice take hold of you because there is wrath. Beware lest he take you away with one blow. For a large ransom would not help you avoid it. Will your riches or all your mighty forces keep you from distress? What riches? Everything Job had has been taken away from him. He has nothing. Do not desire the night when people are caught off in their place. Take heed, do not turn to iniquity, for you have chosen this rather than affliction. And we see the sovereign power of God in controlling the forces of nature. I'll just read this because God expounds upon this himself in the remaining chapters, in the verse chapter 38 through chapter 40. Look at chapter 36. And verse 26, here he starts talking about, we saw the greatness of God in his dealings with men, with sinners, and with the righteous. But here he begins to talk about the greatness of God as far as what we call the forces of nature are concerned. Behold, God is great, and we do not know him. Nor can the number of his years be discovered, for he draws up drops of water, which distill as rain from the midst. This is called the hydrological cycle, where God causes the sun to pick up the water into the clouds, and it begins to rain on other places, which distills rain from the midst, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Indeed, can anyone understand the spreading of a cloud, the thunder from his canopy? Look, he scatters his light upon it. He covers the depths of the sea. For by these he judges the people. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hand with lightning and commands it to strike. His thunder declares it. The cattle also consider the rising storm. At this my heart trembles and leaps from its place. Hear attentively the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. He sends it forth under the whole heavens, his lightning to the ends of the earth after a voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice. He does not restrain them when his voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with his voice. He does great things which we cannot comprehend. But he says to the snow, be on the earth. Next time it snows, remember that's because of the command of God. I'm serious. I'm not being trite. We grumble and complain. Well, May was too cold and June is too hot. When I say we, I mean myself too. But we need to remember these things don't happen by accident. These are all under God's control. He seals the hand of every man, verse 7. All men may enter his work. The animals enter dens and remain in the lyres. From the chamber of the south comes the whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds of the north. By the breath of God, ice is given, and the water, broad waters are frozen. Also with moisture, he saturates the thick clouds. He scatters his bright clouds, and they swirl about, being turned by his guidance, that they may do whatever he commands them. On the face of the whole earth, he causes it to come, whether for correction, or for his land, or for his mercy. Oh, listen to this, O Job. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know when God dispatches him and causes the light of his clouds to shine? Do you know the balance of the clouds, those wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? Why are your garments hot when he quiets the earth by the south wind? With him have you spread out the skies, strong as cast metal. Teach us what you would say to him, for we can prepare nothing because of darkness. Should he be told that I wish to speak? If a man were to speak, surely he would be swallowed up. Even now, man cannot look at the light when it is bright in the skies. When the wind has passed and cleared him, he comes from the north in golden splendor. With God is awesome majesty. As for the Almighty, we cannot find him. He is excellent in power. He in judgment and abundant justice. He does not oppress. Therefore, men fear him. He shows no partiality to those who are wise in heart. Let me just draw a couple lines of application from all of this. If you will remember back in chapter 32, Elihu made this declaration. Go back to chapter 32, verse 14. And speaking of Job, he says, Job never spoke to me or said anything against me, so I'm not going to use the approach you men used. Verse 14, now he has not directed his words against me, so I will not answer him with your words. In other words, I am not going to fall into the trap of you men in charging Job with wickedness and sinfulness. But Solomon said, in a multitude of words, sin is not lacking. And Elihu just talked too much. There was much in it. We saw there was much in what Elihu said that has been very helpful to Job and to us. But he spoke too much. And he fell into the same trap that Job's friends fell into. The more we talk, the more likely we are to sin. In a multitude of words, sin is not lacking, but he who restrains his lips is wise. So we need to be careful that we don't talk more than we should, because eventually we will sin with our mouth. And here is one of the more important. I don't mean that in relationship. I think what he says about God is very exalting of God. But here's a very practical thing that all of us need to remember. The adversity that comes into our lives will either help us or harden us. The hardship that comes into our life, pain, suffering, loss of loved ones, whatever it may be, will either help us or harden us. And if we are saved and we've already been given the gift of faith, then we either choose to submit to what God has ordained and by His grace seek to accept it and bow to it, or we choose to resist God, become angry and bitter against God, and then it hardens us. And this is such an important concept for us to know. Elihu tells Job that adversity and affliction are not always punitive. It is not always evidence of God's wrath. God also brings adversity and suffering into our lives. And he made that clear when he's talking here in chapter 36. He goes on to say how God blesses the righteous. But then he breaks in and he recognizes that sometimes God brings affliction upon us, verse 8. And if they are bound in fetters, held in cords of affliction, then he tells them their work and their transgressions, that they have acted defiantly. Notice he also brings instruction. He also opens their ear to instruction and commands that they turn from iniquity. Now, believers will respond one of two ways. They will either submit to what God has ordained and seek to learn from it, even though it will be painful. And in the end, God will bless them. Look at verse 10. He who opens their ear to instruction and commands that they turn from iniquity, if they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasure. In other words, if we will, by God's grace, submit to whatever God brings into our life, and seek for grace from God to submit to whatever he brings, he will eventually take those hard things and make it work for our good. But if we resist what God is doing, we will become angry, we become embittered, and we will take the blessing that God intended to bring us through that adversity and turn it into a curse. Look at the text, verse 12. But if they do not obey, they shall perish by the sword. They shall die without knowledge. That which God ordains to be a blessing, if we resist it, becomes a curse. And that's easy for me to say that when things are going well in my life. But let me tell you, when we're going through some hard times, there was great resistance in my soul. I was angry and bitter at God. Until I began to see how counterproductive that was, that God wasn't going to be hurt by my anger and bitterness. I was going to be hurt, and everyone around me was going to be hurt by it. Many die in their bitterness, never having learned anything from their experience. Look at verse 12 again. But if they do not obey, they shall perish by the sword and shall die without knowledge. And if a Christian brother or sister does not respond in a positive way, be very patient with them. Encourage them to look at adversity in the proper way, and that's what Elihu did. But don't kick them when they're down like Elihu did to Job. Recognize they're going through hard times. You see, each one of these men were totally aloof and detached from what Job was going through. And it doesn't seem like there was any sympathy in their hearts. There was no getting down with Job and crying out with Job for his loss. And they were aloof and detached. Don't be like that. Take Job's plea to heart. Remember what he said back in chapter 6? Here is a good text to underscore in your Bibles. Verse 14. To him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friends, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. Even though a brother and sister in Christ gets to a point where they're about ready to abandon God and then apostatize, we need to be patient with them. We need to be kind to them. We need to tell them the truth. We don't want to sugarcoat anything, but we need to be patient with them. Lastly, we need to broaden our understanding of the character of God. Read and reread those portions of the Bible that set forth the glory and the majesty of God. Could you feel something of that majesty as we were reading how Elihu was describing God and the forces of nature? What a majestic and powerful God he is. You know, one of the things I have been struggling with in my private prayer life is that we are to, as we pray, we are to hallow his name. And I have been saying to the Lord, Lord, I know words and phrases in the Bible, but I don't know you enough. It's hard for me to hallow your name as I should because I don't know you well enough, even though you've revealed everything you want us to know in the book. Take those majestic portions of God's Word, that where He speaks about His might and His power in creation, and begin to put those things in your mind so when that you can pray, you can speak of the majesty and the glory of our God. I have been so deficient in my private praying with that. But yet, that's one of the first things we should do. But when you're going through hard times, and you find as you've searched that there's no glaring sin in your life, you will be greatly tempted to believe the lies of the devil about God. It will seem that he is unjust, and that there's little profit in serving living godly. But you need to hold up that shield of faith and remind yourself of what Elihu said back in chapter 34 and verse 10. Far be it from God to do wickedness, from the Almighty to commit iniquity, verse 12. Surely God will never do wickedly, nor will the Almighty pervert justice. You see, when God is too small in our minds, our adversity will overcome us. When God is too small in our own minds, our adversity will overcome us. But when we seek to magnify God in our minds by the Word of God, it puts all of our adversity in a proper perspective. And it's at this time that God finally steps in and begins to speak to Job. No, I'm not going there tonight. But in doing so, Job is brought to a proper perspective of himself and of God. It is then that he falls on his face and acknowledges that he spoke of things that he did not understand. One of the main points I want to try to get across, and I've taken you way over, and I appreciate your patience. Try to remember this. If you're a Christian, you already have the faith to believe God. He's already given it to you as a gift. When adversity comes into your life, and let me tell you, it will. Before most of you part from this life, hard times will come. Hard times that you never thought would ever happen to you. And you will now have a choice. Even in the midst of my brokenheartedness, my pain, my anguish, my crying out, my lack of understanding and how everything is all turned upside down, I have the choice. I can choose to trust God and by His grace, and it's only going to take His grace, submit to Him. And eventually He will bless you. Or you can continue to be angry and bitter against God and rail against God, and your heart will become hard and you'll go into the grave with a bitter heart, never having learned a thing from your hardship. Oh, if we can only hold on to that. May God be pleased to remind us of that when He brings those hard times into our life. I've taken you way over. Let's stand and I'll dismiss you in prayer.